Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, July 31st, 2014. Warrap State residents applaud word that road will be repaired and improved.
The government is to pay 519,900 South Sudanese pounds to at least start with 30 kilometers road from our border with Western Bahakazali in Tarkwen.
And does Rwanda's successful peacekeeping operations have implications for South Sudan?
I think they've done a good job. I mean, they've been willing to put themselves on the line to protect civilians.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But first, we go to Addis Ababa. The South Sudan talks, scheduled to resume today, did not kick off in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The regional bloc, IGAD, released a statement early last week announcing the resumption of the on and off peace talks to start this week. Sources close to IGAD told South Sudan in Focus today that the talks have stalled because of logistical problems. The source did not explain the nature of the logistical hitches. South Sudan in Focus will continue to monitor development of the resumption of the peace talks. Mr. Kiir's speech was seen by some as a veiled attack on United States policies in Sudan. The press officer for the U.S. Special Envoy for South Sudan and Sudan, Donald Booth, said Booth's office was aware of Mr. Kiir's remarks but did not have a comment at this time. Luke Pate, a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies and the author of the book about foreign involvement in South Sudan's oil industry, says Kiir is wrong to say the West and the United States is particular after South Sudan's oil. Pate says China is far the biggest player in the industry, South Sudan oil production. He says it would be in Mr. Kiir's interest to try to forge partnership between China and the United States instead of trying to drive a wedge between the two countries. But he says he thinks Mr. Kiir's apparent attack on United States was probably intended for South Sudanese audience, but it could also be a sign of serious things. President Kiir is expected to travel to Washington next week for a summit of African leaders. South Sudan in Focus web editor Karen Zaivogo spoke to Mr. Petty, who is in Denmark. United Nations police in South Sudan say they are intensifying efforts to curb serious crimes occurring within UN IDP camps across South Sudan. UN police or UNPO say some of the people sheltering at the camps have committed murder. The U.S. ambassador to the United States says the world body could learn a lesson from Rwanda's approach to peacekeeping, which may have future implications for peacekeeping operations in South Sudan. Speaking at a UN Security Council debate in New York this week, Ambassador Samantha Power said civilians in war-torn areas trust Rwandese peacekeepers to protect them. She also called on the international community to give regional peacekeeping organizations like the African Union full support. We are having some technical problems here in the studio. We will come back after a short while. President Kiir is warning against consequences of foreign interference in South Sudan. Mr. Kiir said in a speech yesterday to commemorate the millions of South Sudanese who died in a long civil war, made thinly veiled references to earlier U.S. interventions in Africa and Middle East, and say they resulted in chaos.
Berakam in all their divisions be NATO. Somalia jakalo kamsena be duna kuma na jara baramuno be guo betom kan tayarat kan dababat kan matraya na jara be mkulu Somalia Fadol Barao. Anas Domane Yulgom Gadin fi Bullet Batom. Maeji Yelagbatum. Yogululo Galnano de Arina Salahku.
Mr. Kir also cited examples of US-led invasion of Iraq and NATO-led strikes on Libya. He also spoke in his Mother's Day speech of foreign intervention in Syria's civil war.
Lumanaz Majali Iraq. Hassel Chunufi Iraq Hassel. Lumanaz Majali Libya. Hassel Chunufi Libya Hassel. We asked a narge muwalla fi Syria. Hajar jada mafrudi nunaz yago tehet yedwa nasu, lekin ma yamolu belgua. Saddam Hussein mat. We aslaha bita dal damar sham lal galu enu endu. Mafi malugo. Gaddafi berawa menu nu salam hajat betaw na kan bakhaw menu bardu katalu.
Mr. Kir noted that South Sudan does not have weapons of mass destruction. He indirectly accused Western nations of seeking to control South Sudan's oil.
Albawaya naz the resources bidana lenu na fi junu Sudan el arda de albawaya naz.
Those were comments from President Kiir while addressing a crowd in Juba during a Mother's Day yesterday. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says the world body could learn lessons from Rwanda's approach to peacekeeping, which may have future implications for peacekeeping operations in South Sudan. Speaking at a U.N. Security Council debate in New York this week, Ambassador Samantha Paul said civilians in war-torn areas trust Rwandan peacekeepers to protect them. She also called on the international community to give regional peacekeeping organizations like the African Union full support. For VOA News, Nick Long has more from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
A recent internal UN report found that its peacekeeping missions have routinely failed to use force to protect civilians under attack. Referring to this report, Ambassador Power described it as troubling. She contrasted the UN's performance with that of regional organisations such as the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States, which she said have been willing to take on robust protection mandates. She suggested the UN could draw lessons from Rwanda's leadership in particular, as well as that of other countries like Ethiopia and Nepal. Rwandan troops are in demand as peacekeepers, and currently about 5,500 of them are deployed with UN and AU missions, mainly in Darfur, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic. Caspar Agger of the US-based anti-genocide organisation The Enough Project has observed the Rwandan troops with the AU mission in the CAR.
I think they've done a good job. I mean, they've been willing to put themselves on the line to protect civilians, to protect humanitarian workers. They also come from a country with a terrible history of a genocide, and particularly when the fighting was hitting a high, you got the feeling that local populations and the Rwandans could identify with each other's experiences.
VOA observed Rwandan peacekeepers at work in the CAR and asked local people what they thought of them. Truck drivers transporting essential supplies into CAR told VOA that when Rwandan soldiers were deployed to guard their convoys, they took the job seriously. For example, they would stay with any trucks that broke down instead of abandoning them, as other peacekeepers had. Muslims in the capital, Bangui, told VOA it was the Rwandan and Burundian peacekeepers who defended them. In the past month, Rwanda has deployed about 850 peacekeepers to South Sudan, where they are protecting one of the largest camps for displaced civilians at Malakal. South Sudan expert Tag El Khazin, director of the Sub-Sahara Center, suggests they can deter aggressors.
They are the ones with the heavy equipment. They have tanks. They are very well equipped, the Rwandese soldiers.
Al-Khazin said that unlike in CAR, the warring parties in South Sudan have far greater firepower than the peacekeepers. But he thinks the Rwandan and other UN troops can still fulfill their mandate.
They are able to protect the civilians within their compounds, and this is by default, actually, not because the UN is that strong, but because neither the government of South Sudan nor the rebels would want to attack the compounds of the UN because their own people are in there.
In her speech last week, Ambassador Power recognized the challenges the UN and AU missions face to train and equip troops, airlift them to war zones and keep them supplied. This, she said, is why the United States has contributed more than $600 million to AU missions in Somalia and in the CAR, and $166 million for African peacekeepers in Mali, as well as training 250,000 peacekeepers for African operations since 2005. The ambassador emphasized that regional organizations such as the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States are playing a more central role in peacekeeping than ever before and have proven swift and nimble in responding to serious crises. As they step forward, she said, they deserve full support. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
We apologize, we are having some serious technical problems here in the studio, but however, we have still more news for you. Warrap State residents have been complaining about bad roads for years. Now state authorities say they are going to do something about it. Officials have announced plans to repair and maintain roads linking the capital Kwajok to counties as well as other neighboring states. They say the improvement will make it easier to travel from one place to another and allow the government to have goods and services to residents in rural areas more quickly. For VOA News, Santino Monut has more from Kwajok.
State Information Minister Paul Delgum says renovations and maintenance target the entire road network within the state, but they will get started with the most badly damaged areas.
The government is to pay 519,900 South Sudanese pounds to at least start with 30 kilometers road from our border with Western Bahakazali in Tharkweng to Kwajok town and proceed to Gugrial, Udraw, Turale and branch to Akon. The other important road also is from Mapel in Western Bahakazali to Toyin South, Thiet and Toyin East, and again from Panwaya of Western Bahakazali to Gugrial East in Liadnom.
Gum says the road construction company Ayat has donated construction equipment.
That amount is only going to cover for fuel, for the spare parts and maintenance of the equipment, plus the running cost of the workers that will be operating the machines. While Ayat is not going to be paid, it is a good gesture from them to support us by providing the equipment so that we maintain the roads.
Gum appealed to neighboring states to refer their roads to enable people to move easily from one area to another. Residents have welcomed the decision to repair roads, which was made last week at the Council of Ministers meeting. Daya Mohammed, a trader in Kwajok, says it is long overdue.
The repair of the roads by the government of Warrap State, it is a good news, and it will help us as traders to bring our goods from the part of the countries to Warrap State. It should have been done early, such that to help us and to help the community of Warrap State and South Sudan in general.
Resident Luca Loktual Machol, a health officer in Tonyis County, is appealing to the state government to start with roads in his areas so that citizens can access badly needed basic services, including health care.
All the commissioners sit around the table and then they see which county is the worst one. They can consider us, we people of Tonyis, because our road is not good. Like now our drugs are stored in Toyin County because of a bad road.
Resident Makura Wade of Gogrialis County wants the government to establish a committee to ensure that the money approved for road work is used for its intended purpose. Government corruption has been a widespread problem in South Sudan, from the national level down to states and local jurisdiction. Recent evidence have made most roads impassable in Warrap State. As a result, most county headquarters are inaccessible. Work on the roads is scheduled to start in the first week of August. For BOA News, I am Santino Manuda Yuel in Kwajok, Warrap State.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Good personal hygiene is important to protect you, your family, and your community. More than 5,000 children die every day from diarrhea and stomach disorders caused by the bacteria found in human waste. People get sick when these bacteria are spread from person to person on their hands or clothing. But there are things you can do to help stop the spread of infection. Try to relieve yourself far away from where you cook, eat, and store food. Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water after using the latrine. And keep cuts and scrapes clean and covered until they're healed. It is important to you and your family to understand the threat of diseases that can be spread by human waste and avoid them by staying clean.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country or on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. In Juba, listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5. You can also find us on shortwave at 11995, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes a good political leader?
Being there for the people who elected you, not for your own selfish gains.
One who cannot embrace what you call tribalism, nepotism, and racism, that's a good leader.
A good political leader should know that he's at the service of the people, not being a political leader who feels above the people.
A good political leader should be exemplary to the community. They should come back on the ground where they have been looking for the votes, and they see what people they want, and they behave. So that means that if they behave, even the community will behave.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has climbed to 729, including more than 50 new fatalities reported since last Friday. The latest update from the World Health Organization came as officials in Sierra Leone and Liberia moved to enact intensive new measures to stop the Ebola virus from spreading. Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma said the government will quarantine areas where the disease is found, restrict public meetings, search houses to find infected people, and screen passengers at the country's main airport. In Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf announced the closure of schools, the shutdown of markets along border areas, and said all public facilities would be disinfected and chlorinated on Friday. Ukraine's parliament has rejected the resignation of Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who announced last week his intention to step down after the two parties supporting him left the ruling coalition. The legislature voted today not to accept Mr. Yatsenyuk's resignation, despite his loss of political backing. The lawmakers also approved legislation backed by Mr. Yatsenyuk to help fund the fight against pro-Russian separatists in the east. Mr. Yatsenyuk had warned that without the funding, Ukraine would default on its debt, undermining a $17 billion loan package from the International Monetary Fund. And finally, the United Nations' top human rights official is accusing Israel and Hamas militants of possible war crimes in the conflict in Gaza. Navi Pillay told reporters today that Israel has attacked homes, schools, hospitals, and United Nations premises in an apparent violation of international law, adding that the international community in the words of Ms. Pillay cannot allow this lack of accountability to go on, end quote. She also condemned Hamas for firing rockets indiscriminately into Israel and for using United Nations areas as a repository for weapons. And that's a look at some of today's top news stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
We go to West Africa on the latest on the Ebola outbreak. An NGO says containing the West Africa Ebola epidemic will require overcoming fear and stigma surrounding the disease. Action Aid says the high death rate has caused a lack of faith in the medical system. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports on the group's effort to help contain the outbreak in Sierra Leone.
The World Health Organization says there have been more than 470 confirmed cases of Ebola in Sierra Leone. There are several hundred more suspected cases. More than 230 people have died. ActionAid Country Director Mohamed Sila says the major challenge facing Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia is a poor health infrastructure. He says the countries are simply not well equipped to handle the crisis because of a lack of investment in health. Sila says those countries need to act to change that.
First, it has to do with necessary training for the staff, equipping the staff with the basic equipment that they need to actually carry out their work. Issues as simple as an ambulance is a challenge for major hospitals. If you have a suspected case, there are very limited ambulances around to collect the sick people and easily isolate them.
He says many community health centers lack access to electricity. That means no refrigeration to safely store vaccines or drugs that are susceptible to heat. Another major problem is fear, and fear of Ebola is widespread among the population. The ActionAid country director says many people actually deny the existence of the disease and attribute the sickness and death to some other cause. Also, the message that was sent out after the Ebola outbreak was confirmed was that it had no cure. When families did bring their sick relatives to the hospital, patients were immediately placed in quarantine, and the family lost contact with them.
That lack of communication, that lack of clarity brought about the mistrust. People saw the hospitals now as a death zone. What happened in the isolation centers was not very, very clear to the general public.
There have been several incidents in Sierra Leone where families removed infected people from hospitals. Those incidents, Sila says, not only indicate the lack of information families had about the disease, but the lack of security at the health facilities. But what message can be sent when a disease is so often fatal? Sila says it has to do with educating the communities. ActionAid staff and others are going door to door in Sierra Leone doing just that, explaining prevention methods, signs and symptoms, and the importance of taking people to the hospital.
Because we have a long-term presence in the communities, they trust us. They trust the information that we give them.
Local and traditional leaders play a big role in those education efforts. Sila also says there's a lack of testing centers. For example, there are just two in eastern Sierra Leone. One is run by the Ministry of Health and the other by Doctors Without Borders. Some people may have to travel hundreds of kilometers to reach them and then wait 2 or 3 days for the results. It was during that waiting period that families removed patients from health facilities. One thing being done to raise hope among the population is to talk about the people who became infected and survived. ActionAid, the Ministry of Health, and many volunteers are sending the message that medical care gives people a chance of overcoming the disease. And they point to the nearly 130 infected people who have so far. And those survivors are now helping to educate the population through media campaigns.
We are gaining confidence of the people. And what you can even see from the government figures is that the number of people who are reporting to the health center is actually increasing.
Sila is calling for greater international support for Sierra Leone to increase the number of Ebola rapid testing centers. He says this would go a long way toward controlling the outbreak. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Poachers make millions of dollars each year by the illegal killing of endangered African wildlife. They sell elephant or rhino tusks around the world, for example, as trophies. But U.S. government is taking action. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services say it recently confirmed the suspension of imported trophies of elephant killed in Zimbabwe or after April 4, 2014. The suspension comes after a review of Zimbabwe to verify whether Harare was complying with the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Tim Von Norman is the chief of branch of the permits for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He spoke with Kim Lewis about the findings of the study which led to Zimbabwe's suspension.
We were looking at whether the hunting of elephants as sport trophies provided a benefit or enhanced the species in the wild. This is coming under the requirements of the Endangered Species Act that says that the import of trophy elephants has to provide that benefit or enhancement. And so we were looking for that, particularly within Zimbabwe. Is the hunting program in Zimbabwe, U.S. hunters going to Zimbabwe, are they providing for the benefit to the species?
And did you find that they were?
We did not. We made a finding on July 17th that basically stated that there was not sufficient information from Zimbabwe to determine that the activities going on there were benefiting the species.
What type of activities were taking place?
Well, what we were looking for as far as trying to determine enhancement was to find out if the hunting programs were well managed on a scientific basis. Was revenue that was coming in from U.S. hunters being utilized in a manner that further benefited the elephant, either through, you know, developing management programs, anti-poaching activities, addressing human-elephant conflicts? You know, U.S. hunters spend quite a bit of money when they go hunting. Much of that goes back into the economy. Some portion of that is also going to the government or to regional government officials or authorities. And so what we were trying to find out is, was that money being utilized in a manner that provided benefit to the elephants? And we didn't have documentation or evidence to say that it did. Conversely, we didn't have anything that saying that it wasn't, but our finding has to say that there is a benefit, not just a zero-sum game.
As a result, then, there was a suspension of the import of elephant trophies for Zimbabwe. What is the next step, then? What takes place after this?
We have sent a letter to Zimbabwe. We're hoping that we can work with them to identify where there's information gaps. The hope is that the information is there, that they're doing these activities. It just was not relayed to us when we communicated with them earlier. In April, we established an interim suspension in the hope of getting information. We received a lot of information from Zimbabwe, as well as from NGOs and interested parties. And based on that information, we made our decision on July 17th that basically, of the information that was available, it was not enough to support making an enhancement finding.
Also, in your press release, you pointed out that you're going to be reevaluating Zimbabwe in December of this year.
We certainly will. If we don't get more information between now and then, we do want to look at what's happening in Zimbabwe so that we can make a decision for the coming year. The current suspension only applies for 2014. We need to make a new finding for 2015. The hope is that in November, December, we can get enough information to lift the suspension. But it will depend on what happens in Zimbabwe and what information is provided to us.
Is there concern of the elephant population dwindling in Zimbabwe?
No, it's certainly not dwindling. The problem is, and stated in our finding, is that there hasn't been any recent countrywide surveys of elephant populations. There is currently right now an effort to do I believe it's called the Pan-African Aerial Elephant Survey, which would look at the elephant populations across much of southern and eastern Africa. The hope would be that with that survey, we get a very good idea of the population numbers within Zimbabwe. It would also give an indication of the mortality rate. How many animals are dying? Is it above or below normal mortality rates? You would expect a certain number of elephants to die of old age or other activities, disease. Does the counting the carcasses that they'll do during this aerial survey, does it indicate that there's poaching? So that information would be very important. Right now, Zimbabwe says that they have approximately 100,000 elephants. We'd like to get information to show that that is accurate, or is it overestimated, underestimated, and what's the level of poaching that's going on.
That was Tim Van Norman, Chief of Branch of Permit of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. He spoke with Kim Lewis from Falls Church, Virginia. And that brings us to the end of our show for today. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for listening, and we apologize for the technical glitches we had during this show.